This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, May 10th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, BP's attempt to cover the main oil leak in the Gulf Coast has been suspended. We'll go to the region to hear about the impact on local residents in the fishing industry. Obama nominates Solicitor General Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. And we'll go to Afghanistan, where civilians affected by the decades-long violence meet in a victim's justice jirga. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A U.S. drone fired two missiles in northwest Pakistan, killing at least 10 people and possibly as many as 20, according to Pakistani security officials. It's the second drone attack in the past week. Also in the region, 30 reported Taliban members and 10 Pakistani soldiers were killed today in an ambush on a military search team. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder says the Obama administration plans to seek greater powers to hold terrorism suspects without reading them their Miranda rights. Currently, authorities can delay telling arrestees they have the right to remain silent and to an attorney, but that delay is permitted only if they believe the suspect has information that could put others in immediate danger, the so-called public safety exception. But speaking on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Holder said that exception is not strong enough to deal with international terrorists.
Yeah, we certainly need more flexibility, and we want the public safety exception to be consistent with the public safety concerns that we now have in the 21st century.
Holder says he will be working with Congress to change the law. Republicans have argued that terrorism suspects should be tried in military court and denied virtually all the legal rights of civilians facing charges, including Miranda rights. More than 30 people have been killed in a pair of explosions in a Russian coal mine, and rescuers are racing to save dozens more trapped inside. The first explosion on Saturday night trapped more than 50 miners. A second explosion 4 hours later trapped 19 rescue workers who had entered the mine. Russian officials say there's a 48-hour window before the areas where several of the miners are trapped will likely flood with water. As negotiations continue to form a new government in Britain, Prime Minister Gordon Brown announced that he would resign as leader of the Labour Party. George Lavender reports.
Gordon Brown said he expected elections to be held for a new leader of the Labour Party before the party conference in September.
I have no desire to stay in my position longer than is needed. I therefore intend to ask the Labour Party to set and train the processes needed for its own leadership election.
No party gained an overall majority in the British general election last week, but the Conservative Party won the most seats. Brown said that result was a reflection on his leadership. Negotiations between the Conservative and Liberal Democrat parties over a possible coalition government had been expected to result in a Conservative-led administration, with David Cameron as Prime Minister. But the two parties continue to disagree on the issue of electoral reform. The announcement today means that Gordon Brown could continue as Prime Minister of a coalition government until a new leader of the Labour Party is selected. George Lavender, FSRN, London.
European governments and the International Monetary Fund have approved a rescue package of just under $1 trillion as they attempt to stem an economic crisis throughout the EU. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The package makes $77 billion for emergency loans available to countries like Spain, Ireland and Portugal, who may be on the brink of similar financial meltdown. Because European banks are so involved in each other's sovereign debt problems, more than $500 billion will go towards bilateral loan guarantees. They're hoping it'll get lending going again. The involvement of Goldman Sachs in the Greek crisis is also emerging today. Critics say they helped Greece create derivative contracts structured in a way that disguised the true extent of Greece's borrowing. Italy used a similar trick to mask its true debt with the help of a different US bank. Goldman Sachs says they kept to European Union rules, but told its shareholders today that it's subject to a number of investigations and reviews over its dealings with Greece. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
In Zimbabwe, the High Court today acquitted Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's ally Roy Bennett of terrorism charges. The decision follows a lengthy court battle in a case that would have led to a death penalty if he was found guilty. Davison Makanga reports.
The Movement for Democratic Change party says Bennett should now take his post as Deputy Minister for Agriculture. He was nominated last year but has not been able to occupy the office due to criminal charges against him. President Robert Mugabe repeatedly refused to preside over Bennett's oath of office due to the terrorism case, fueling accusations that the charges were politically motivated. MDC spokesperson Nelson Chamisa.
All the stumbling blocks have been cleared, so we are expecting to have tomorrow Honorable Bennett as a Deputy Minister of Agriculture because he's an angel. He has no case to answer.
Bennett's acquittal has also rekindled debate about Attorney General Johannes Tomana's fitness for office. Tomana is one of the sticking points in the Sheikh Inclusive Government formed last year. Now that he has lost one high-profile case, analysts say the MDC will have more legitimacy in calling for his dismissal. Tevson Makanga, Free Speech Radio News.
Sunday's elections in the Philippines were plagued by malfunctioning voting machines, and polls were kept open an extra hour as more than 40 million people cast their vote for more than 50,000 candidates running for president, Congress, and local government seats. Violence was also a problem. At least 10 people were killed, and several towns postponed voting out of fear. This was the first major election to use electronic voting machines. There were hopes the new machines would prevent vote rigging, but problems ranging from electrical outages to clogged ballot slots led to waits as long as 7 hours at the polls. We'll have more coverage of the elections in the Philippines later this week. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News, from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. In the Gulf Coast, the effort to lower a containment dome over the main oil leak of the Deepwater Horizon site was suspended over the weekend. British Petroleum said today that a buildup of hydrates prevented the placement of the dome over the spill area. The company now says it is preparing a second, smaller dome to fit over the leak, but also noted that it has never been done in this deep water. The damaged oil well is 5,000 feet below the surface and continues to gush 5,000 barrels of oil per day into coastal waters. The oil slick coating the water has been moving toward the Louisiana coast, threatening the marshes surrounding the mouth of the Mississippi River. The area is one of the richest fishing areas in the country, but the spill is threatening to put an end to the industry and forcing thousands of fishermen out of work. From Louisiana, FSRN's Zoe Sullivan has more.
Fishing is one of Louisiana's mainstay industries. According to the state's Office of Coastal Management, commercial fishing brought in nearly 850 million pounds of fish, worth an estimated $200 million in 2006, the year after Hurricane Katrina. This figure accounts for just over one-fifth of the entire catch in the lower 48 states. Fishermen are facing the possibility that their trade may become impossible. For many, this means the end to a way of life that has been practiced by generations. Kevin Heer, who's been fishing since he was 16, is one such person. He spoke with FSRN in St. Bernard Parish.
It's a sad situation, getting worse by the second. It's hard to deal with it mentally. I mean, you got every day you come home, you see bills coming in the mail, and you can't work. You got your life, your life. It took, half my life to get what I got, and it's all sitting out there, and I can't even go use it, run it. It's like it's just been taken away.
Heer says he travels 100 miles to get to work, 6 and sometimes 7 days a week.
I mean, every day of my life, I can't wake up, walk out my house, come here, even if I'm not working. Every morning I get up at 5, 6 o'clock in between shedding crabs all night. I got shedding tanks where I make soft shells at my house, and I got to get up every 2 or 3 hours and check them. And this is the time of year from, basically April to July is, where we make our year mostly. And that's just taken away from us.
This new disaster follows the devastation of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, which also affected the St. Bernard Parish fishing industry. Tim Gonzalez has lived in the parish his entire life. He reflected on what this new catastrophe would mean.
The St. Bernard Parish here where we're standing right now, after Katrina, the only people that came back was the people that could physically make a living on these waters. We were 60,000 plus, and now we're down to 25, maybe there's some more now. So only the people that make living on these waters, this parish is going to dry up. It's going to be a ghost town. If we can't come out on these waters and make a living, we can't live in St. Bernard. Where's the jobs going to come from?
Louisiana is also home to thousands of Vietnamese immigrants. Some estimates put the number of Vietnamese living in southern Louisiana at 25,000. Many came to the U.S. to escape the Vietnam War and its aftermath, and fishing was a livelihood that transferred well to the Mississippi Delta. Tai Phan has lived in Louisiana since 1978. He's worked as a baker, but has been fishing in recent years. He says there are not a lot of options for most Vietnamese immigrants of his generation.
Actually, we have no other choice. You come to America, you don't have enough education and all that, so if you want to do something else, you have to have a degree for that. So we're an open fisherman.
To get by, some fishermen are taking jobs with BP, laying out protective booms to stop the oil from reaching the shore. The company had asked those participating in the effort to sign a waiver giving up their right to file future claims for physical injury that might result from the toxins in the oil and dispersants. After fishermen protested during the first week of May, however, the company said it would not make signing a release of liability a condition for employment. Tim Gonzalez is cynical about BP and its jobs for the fishermen.
They want us to work and feel like we're doing something, but we know we're just being pacified right now. But what you gonna do? We're trying to do what we can to save the marsh. But when you really sit back and look at it, and you look at a map and a little bit of area that we're covering, and we know the currents, what they're doing, unless we get a big shipment of some kind of supplies in here to stop this all from coming in here, it's coming in. It might not come in one day, it's going to take 3 days, but it's coming in.
And that was Zoe Sullivan reporting from St. Bernard Parish. As of Friday, the federal government had placed nearly 11,000 square miles off limits for fishing, stretching from the Southwest Pass of the Mississippi River to Pensacola, Florida. President Obama nominated Elena Kagan to replace Justice John Paul Stevens on the Supreme Court. If confirmed, she would be the youngest member on the court and would be one of three sitting women, which is an historical first. President Obama called her a trailblazing leader, but members of the progressive legal community are disappointed in the president's decision. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
President Obama highlighted Elena Kagan's appeal.
Her openness to a broad array of viewpoints. Her habit, to borrow a phrase from Justice Stevens, of understanding before disagreeing. Her fair-mindedness and skill as a consensus builder.
Kagan has never been a judge. She's currently the U.S. Solicitor General, or nation's attorney. If confirmed by the Senate, she would go from a lawyer arguing cases on one side of the bench to a justice hearing arguments on the other. Senator Patrick Leahy, chair of the Judiciary Committee, said he expects no surprises while parsing through her record.
We've recently reviewed her record in connection with a nomination to be Solicitor General. That's a position where she received bipartisan support. In some ways, this makes our job easier because it was such a short time ago that we had the confirmation hearing of her, went through all the same issues that we're going to have to go through again.
But during her confirmation hearing to be Solicitor General, Kagan made statements that worry some progressives. Kagan said she agreed with the policies of indefinite detention during wartime and that the battlefield is everywhere. Marjorie Cohn, professor of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School, said Elena Kagan's acceptance of those policies is troubling and that her silence during the Bush administration's so-called war on terror was deafening.
Many, many law professors across the country, including me, wrote, spoke out, objected to those policies, and we didn't hear a word from Elena Kagan.
That, though, has caused some to support her. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina wrote in a statement that he has been, quote, generally pleased with her term as Solicitor General, especially on legal issues of terrorism. Kagan spent two decades in academia. She and President Obama knew each other from teaching at the University of Chicago Law School. She then moved to Harvard Law School, where she eventually became dean. Obama highlighted her ability to diffuse political and ideological tension among the law faculty at Harvard. She hired 32 new tenure or tenured-track professors, some conservatives, to diversify the overwhelmingly liberal slant. But Guy Ariel Charles, professor of law at Duke University, said her diversity lacked color and gender.
she pulled out all the stops and made sure that the institution hired conservatives and became much more ideologically diverse. We would have liked to have seen similar actions with respect to racial inclusion.
Of the 32 new professors, Charles said only 7 were women and 1 was Asian. No blacks nor Latinos were hired. Meanwhile, Republicans are pointing to a high-profile stand where she banned military recruiters from Harvard's campus because of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. She called it a moral injustice. Heather Heidelberg is vice president of the Republican National Lawyers Association. She says Kagan's views are outside the mainstream.
She took her own personal views about the situation, contrary to what the law was, and that's a bad precedent for a Supreme Court future Supreme Court judge. She should have known what the law was and followed the law as the Harvard Law School dean.
Kagan clerked for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, whom she calls her hero. Republicans are criticizing that as well, because Marshall called the Constitution, as it was originally written, defective. Marshall was referring to slavery, which was written into the Constitution. Kagan also worked under the Clinton administration. Her work led to greater regulation of the tobacco industry. Her colleague during the Clinton administration, Elaine Carmick, is now a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She says Kagan is a non-threatening consensus builder. She also says she's a moderate centrist.
She is a Democrat. Is she a far-left, ultra-liberal Democrat? No, not by any stretch of the imagination.
Democrats plan to hold confirmation hearings for Kagan this summer. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai arrived in the U.S. today to begin talks with U.S. officials. He's expected to meet with President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Defense Secretary Robert Gates. The visit comes at a tense time for relations between the two countries, as Karzai has increasingly criticized U.S. policies publicly, and U.S. and NATO killings of Afghan civilians have increased. The U.S. military is also planning an offensive in Kandahar. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, residents gathered in Kabul on Sunday ahead of a peace jirga planned for the end of the month. The meeting was an effort to create a space where victims shared their experiences of 3 decades of war and violence. Many demanded an end to injustice. FSRN's Osman Amadi reports.
About 300 people attended the victims' jirga held in the Sharnow area of Kabul. Some came to ask for an apology, others came to hear the tragic stories of Afghan victims of war. Asila Rahmani is a 23-year-old from the northern province of Tahar who recalled an attack on her town during the Taliban regime.
When I was in the 7th grade, the Taliban bombed a plaza near where I was living. They airbombed the area, and all the shopkeepers and the local people were killed. The bombing was so bad that their hands and legs were scattered all over the place. No one could be recognized. Among those killed was my little brother.
Rahmani's father was injured in the same bombing. Her father lived but had to find means to care for her family and her newly born triplet siblings. Rahmani was teary-eyed and choked up as she was recounting her story, but she reinforced the fact that peace and stability could return if criminals are brought to justice.
The Taliban would come for 2 months and shut down all the schools. Afterward, people would come together to rebuild the schools and organize the students. When the Taliban returned, they would burn down our schools, and that's how it went until the end.
In 2004, the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, or AIHRC, conducted a population survey of more than 4,000 people from 32 provinces. The results revealed persecution on an immense level, including nearly 70% of survey respondents identifying themselves or their immediate families as direct victims of a serious human rights violation. Despite the tragic stories, many people are hopeful for the future. Nadir Nadiri is a commissioner with the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission.
People in this room today demonstrated that they are realistic, they do want peace, but they do also want a lasting peace that encompasses justice with it. And that is something that could be considered of a high value.
Human rights groups also called on the government to repeal a law that gives amnesty to perpetrators of human rights violations committed before 2001. Groups say the state has a duty to investigate and prosecute war crimes, and the government shouldn't usurp the rights of victims. Khodadad Bisharat is a member of the Transitional Justice Coordination Group. Bisharat says without justice for victims, violence and conflict will continue.
They have been ignored many times in different areas, in different times, and therefore we cannot stop fighting in war and conflicts in Afghanistan. We are thinking this is the best idea, at least to stand, to think, and how we should stop more fighting, more conflict in Afghanistan. The best way is bringing justice.
The upcoming peace jirga is scheduled for the end of May, but it's already been delayed once. The main topic of the jirga, or large assembly, will be how to end the war in Afghanistan and, specifically, reconciliation with the Taliban, if at all. Again, Nadiri with the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission.
We hope that the peace jirga would provide an opportunity like this for the people, like this event today, for the people and for the representative of the victims to raise their voice and to come with the concrete steps and formulas for the reconciliation process.
Despite the upcoming jirga and meetings amongst officials from Afghanistan and elsewhere, there is likely to be more violence this summer as NATO and the International Security Assistance Force prepares for a Marja-like offensive in Kandahar, the biggest city in southern Afghanistan and the birthplace of the Taliban movement. Almost 2 weeks ago, the United Nations shut down its mission in Kandahar and evacuated many foreign staff from the city. Many civilians living in that area have no other choice but to stay throughout the offensive. Asma Namadi, FSRN, Kabul.
A senior U.S. diplomat met with imprisoned Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi today. It was the first meeting since Suu Kyi's opposition party, the National League for Democracy, officially disbanded last week. Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Kurt Campbell, met with Suu Kyi in Rangoon. Her political party shut down after the ruling military junta released rules that would have required strict registration guidelines and other limitations on the party's participation in the upcoming elections. The party led by Aung San Suu Kyi won the 1990 election but was stopped from taking power by the military junta. Myanmar, also known as Burma, has been ruled by the military since then. Suu Kyi has been under house arrest for 14 years. Under the Obama administration, the U.S. has attempted to engage the military junta. Last week, Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Philip Crowley responded to the news that the National League for Democracy, or NLD, had disbanded. He said members should still have a role to play in the democratic process.
Well, I think we obviously see the NLD as part of a legitimate democratic opposition, and as we have indicated to Burma, through the meetings that we've had, ultimately Burma has to open up greater political space and have a meaningful dialogue with political opposition as well as other ethnic groups.
While in the region, Assistant Secretary Kurt Campbell also met with lower-ranking government ministers in the ruling military. According to Reuters, he warned leaders that elections would, quote, lack international legitimacy unless the process was made more democratic. Campbell also called for the immediate release of an estimated 2,100 political prisoners held in the country. The U.S. Special Envoy for Peace in the Middle East, George Mitchell, left the region on Sunday after completing the first round of proximity talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. While the State Department described the first round of discussions as, quote, serious and wide-ranging, those talks may now be at risk. FSRN's Ghassan Banora has the story.
Peace talks have been stalled for 16 months following the Israeli elections of the hardline government headed by the Likud party of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. In an effort to relaunch the process, U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell has started a series of proximity talks. The first round took place over the weekend when Mitchell met with Israeli and Palestinian leaders separately in Jerusalem and Ramallah. While few details of the talks were released, The State Department said there was some progress, including Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's willingness to work against incitement and Prime Minister Netanyahu's pledge to halt construction for 2 years at the Ramat Shlomo settlement project in Jerusalem. But many obstacles remain. On Monday, the Israeli mayor of Jerusalem near Barakat vowed to continue building settlements in all parts of Jerusalem. Israel's Minister of National Infrastructure also said that a construction freeze is a serious error and vowed to take his concerns to Netanyahu. These moves have angered Palestinians. Hanna Amira is a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee.
The main issue is settlement construction. If continued settlement construction is confirmed, this will lead to the halt of any talks. So the announcement by the Israeli mayor of Jerusalem is considered to be an additional provocation. The U.S. should live up to its guarantees regarding this issue, especially the settlements.
The U.S. State Department said it would hold both sides accountable if either takes any action that may undermine trust during the negotiations. In the street, Palestinians remain skeptical about the renewed talks.
It will fail like the previous ones because it lacks a solid foundation.
Of course it will fail, like the past ones did. From experience, we have not benefited at all from negotiating with Israel.
Since talks started, I did not see any change. So those talks will be the same and fail.
The Israeli Prime Minister said on Sunday that he wants to go into direct talks with the Palestinians soon. The Hamas movement in the Gaza Strip, along with other factions, opposed the talks, saying the negotiations only give Israel more time to construct settlements and attack Palestinians. Mitchell will return to the region next week in an attempt to continue the proximity talks. Ghassan Bannoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
Lena Horne, pioneering African-American singer and performer, has died in New York. She was 92. Horne was the first black performer to secure a long-term contract in Hollywood and went on to become internationally recognized in film, radio, television, and musicals. The title song from the 1943 musical Stormy Weather became a signature number for her.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather. Since my man and I together, keeps raining all the time.
Horne also fought for civil rights and criticized the way black soldiers were treated while touring army camps for the USO. In the 1950s, her friendships with W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson and her association with the Council for African Affairs landed her on the blacklist. Later, she continued to perform and received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences in 1998. And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks so much for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.
If those historic gentlemen came back today, Jefferson, Washington, and Lincoln, and Walter Cronkite put them on Channel 2 to find out what they were thinking. I'm sure they'd say, thanks for quoting us so much, but we don't want to take a bow.